The strain was beginning to tell. Wilde sat at the rudder with the same calm, confident expression that he would have worn under happier conditions. His steel-blue eyes looked out to the day ahead. All the people, though evidently suffering, were doing their best to be cheerful, and the prospect of a hot breakfast was inspiriting. I told all the boats that immediately we could find a suitable floe, the cooker would be started, and hot milk and Bovril would soon fix everybody up. Away we rowed to the westward through open pack, floes of all shapes and sizes on every side of us, and every man not engaged in pulling looked eagerly for a suitable camping place. I could gauge the desire for food of the different members by the eagerness they displayed in pointing out to me the floes they considered exactly suited to our purpose. The temperature was about 10 degrees Fahrenheit, and the Burberry suits of the rowers crackled as the men bent to the oars. I noticed little fragments of ice and frost falling from arms and bodies. At 8 o'clock, a decent floe appeared ahead, and we pulled up to it. The galley was landed, and soon the welcome steam rose from the cooking food as the blubber stove flared and smoked. Never did a cook work under more anxious scrutiny. Worsley, Crean, and I stayed in our respective boats to keep them steady and prevent collisions with the floe, since the swell was still running strong, but the other men were able to stretch their cramped limbs and run to and fro in the kitchen, as somebody put it. The sun was now rising gloriously. The Burberry suits were drying and the ice was melting off our beards. The steaming food gave us new vigour, and within 3/4 of an hour we were off again to the west with all sails set. We had given an additional sail to the Stancomb Wills, and she was able to keep up pretty well. We could see that we were on the true pack edge, with the blue rolling sea just outside the fringe of ice to the north. White-capped waves vied with the glittering floes in the setting of blue water, and countless seals basked and rolled on every piece of ice big enough to form a raft. We had been making westward with oars and sails since April 9th, and fair easterly winds had prevailed. Hopes were running high as to the noon observation for position. The optimists thought we had done 60 miles towards our goal, and the most cautious guess gave us at least 30 miles. The bright sunshine and the brilliant scene around us may have influenced our anticipations. As noon approached, I saw Worsley, as navigating officer, balancing himself on the gunwale of the Dudley Docker, with his arm around the mast, ready to snap the sun. He got his observation, and we waited eagerly while he worked out the sight. Then the Dudley Docker ranged up alongside the James Caird, and I jumped into Worsley's boat in order to see the result. It was a grievous disappointment. Instead of making a good run to the westward, we had made a big drift to the southeast. We were actually 30 miles to the east of the position we had occupied when we left the floe on the 9th. It has been noted by sealers operating in this area that there are often heavy sets to the east in the Belgica Straits, and no doubt it was one of these sets that we had experienced. The originating cause would be a northwesterly gale off Cape Horn, producing the swell that had already caused us so much trouble. After a whispered consultation with Worsley and Wilde, I announced that we had not made as much progress as we expected, but I did not inform the hands of our retrograde movement. The question of our course now demanded further consideration. Deception Island seemed to be beyond our reach. The wind was foul for Elephant Island, and as the sea was clear to the southwest, I discussed with Worsley and Wilde the advisability of proceeding to Hope Bay on the mainland of the Antarctic continent, now only 80 miles distant. Elephant Island was the nearest land, but it lay outside the main body of pack, and even if the wind had been fair, we would have hesitated at that particular time to face the high sea that was running in the open. We laid a course roughly for Hope Bay, and the boats moved on again. I gave Worsley a line for a berg ahead, and told him, if possible, to make fast before darkness set in. This was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We had set sail, and as the Stancomb Wills could not keep up with the other two boats, I took her in tow, not being anxious to repeat the experience of the day we left the reeling berg. The Dudley Docker went ahead, but came beating down towards us at dusk. Worsley had been close to the berg, and he reported that it was unapproachable. It was rolling in the swell and displaying an ugly ice foot. The news was bad. In the failing light, we turned towards a line of pack and found it so tossed and churned by the sea that no fragment remained big enough to give us an anchorage and shelter. 2 miles away, we could see a larger piece of ice, and to it we managed, after some trouble, to secure the boats. I brought my boat bow on to the floe, whilst Howe, with painter in his hand, stood ready to jump. Standing up to watch our chance, while the oars were held ready to back the moment Howe had made his leap, I could see that there would be no possibility of getting the galley ashore that night. Howe just managed to get a footing on the edge of the floe, and then made the painter fast to a hummock. The other two boats were fastened alongside the James Caird. They could not lie astern of us in a line, since cakes of ice came drifting round the floe and gathering under its lee. As it was, we spent the next 2 hours poling off the drifting ice that surged towards us. The blubber stove could not be used, so we started the primus lamps. There was a rough, choppy sea, and the Dudley Docker could not get her primus under way, something being adrift. The men in that boat had to wait until the cook on the James Caird had boiled up the first pot of milk. The boats were bumping so heavily that I had to slack away the painter of the Stancomb Wills and put her astern. Much ice was coming round the floe and had to be poled off. Then the Dudley Docker, being the heavier boat, began to damage the James Caird, and I slacked the Dudley Docker away. The James Caird remained moored to the ice, with the Dudley Docker and the Stancomb Wills in line behind her. The darkness had become complete, and we strained our eyes to see the fragments of ice that threatened us. Presently we thought we saw a great berg bearing down upon us, its form outlined against the sky. But this startling spectacle resolved itself into a low-lying cloud in front of the rising moon. The moon appeared in a clear sky. The wind shifted to the southeast as the light improved and drove the boat's broadside on towards the jagged edge of the floe. We had to cut the painter of the James Caird and pole her off, thus losing much valuable rope. There was no time to cast off. Then we pushed away from the floe, and all night long we lay in the open, freezing sea, the Dudley Docker now ahead, the James Caird astern of her, and the Stancomb Wills third in line. The boats were attached to one another by their painters. Most of the time the Dudley Docker kept the James Caird and the Stancomb Wills up to the swell, and the men who were rowing were in better pass than those in the other boats, waiting inactive for the dawn. The temperature was down to 4 degrees below zero, and a film of ice formed on the surface of the sea. When we were not on watch, we lay in each other's arms for warmth. Our frozen suits thawed where our bodies met, and as the slightest movement exposed these comparatively warm spots to the biting air, we clung motionless, whispering each to his companion our hopes and thoughts. Occasionally, from an almost clear sky, came snow showers, falling silently on the sea and laying a thin shroud of white over our bodies and our boats. The dawn of April 13th came clear and bright, with occasional passing clouds. Most of the men were now looking seriously worn and strained. Their lips were cracked, and their eyes and eyelids showed red in their salt-encrusted faces. The beards even of the younger men might have been those of patriarchs, for the frost and the salt spray had made them white. I called the Dudley Docker alongside and found that the condition of the people there was no better than in the James Caird. Obviously we must make land quickly, and I decided to run for Elephant Island. The wind had shifted fair for that rocky isle, then about 100 miles away, and the pack that separated us from Hope Bay had closed up during the night from the south. At 6 a.m. we made a distribution of the stores among the three boats, in view of the possibility of their being separated. The preparation of a hot breakfast was out of the question. The breeze was strong and the sea was running high in the loose pack around us. We had a cold meal, and I gave orders that all hands might eat as much as they pleased, this concession being due partly to a realization that we would have to jettison some of our stores when we reached open sea in order to lighten the boats. I hoped, moreover, that a full meal of cold rations would compensate to some extent for the lack of warm food and shelter. Unfortunately, some of the men were unable to take advantage of the extra food owing to seasickness. Poor fellows, it was bad enough to be huddled in the deeply laden, spray-swept boats, frostbitten and half-frozen, without having the pangs of seasickness added to the list of their woes. But some smiles were caused even then by the plight of one man, who had a habit of accumulating bits of food against the day of starvation that he seemed always to think was at hand, and who was condemned now to watch impotently while hungry comrades with undisturbed stomachs made biscuits, rations, and sugar disappear with extraordinary rapidity. We ran before the wind through the loose pack, a man in the bow of each boat trying to pole off with a broken oar the lumps of ice that could not be avoided. I regarded speed as essential. Sometimes collisions were not averted. The James Caird was in the lead, where she bore the brunt of the encounters with lurking fragments, and she was holed above the waterline by a sharp spur of ice, but this mishap did not stay us.